Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. It looks like our music didn't cue up. It actually sounds like our break music got stuck in the beginning of break music. You might check that, George, see if the CD for the break is in there. Sounded like Mose Allison. Anyway, welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. How we respond to the stress we endure has a formative function in who we become. The degree of disruption that stressful events have on us is often determined by our biology and how we care for ourselves. Understanding the biology of cascading events, the ones that occur in all our organs and glands under the stimulus of stress, may give us opportunities and choices for healthful adaptation, at least I believe so. Joining us today to discuss the science behind the way we feel is Stanford professor and author, neuroscientist Dr. Robert Sapolsky. Robert Sapolsky was born in Brooklyn in 1957, a pup. He's just a pup. He received an AB degree, summa cum laude, in biological anthropology from Harvard University. His PhD in neuroendocrinology was granted in 1984 from the Rockefeller University in New York. Since 1995, Sapolsky has been a professor at Stanford University's neuroscience program and its program in molecular and genetic medicine. For more than a decade, he's been a research associate at the Institute of Primate Research operated by the National Museums of Kenya in Nairobi, Africa. Dr. Sapolsky is the author of several publications, including Stress, the Aging Brain, and the Mechanisms of Neuron Death, and his rather famous two books, The Trouble with Testosterone and Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, A Guide to Stress-Related Diseases and Coping, and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Award. He also regularly contributes to magazines and journals such as Discover, Science, Scientific American, Harper's, and The New Yorker. Dr. Sapolsky's teaching awards include Stanford University's Bing Award for Teaching Excellence and an award for outstanding teaching from the Associated Students of Stanford University. His students love him, and so do we. Welcome to you. Are you with us?
Yes. Hi.
Shall I call you Dr. Sapolsky?
Definitely not.
Okay.
How are you?
I'm pretty weird. Yeah. How about you?
That seems about the best one for these days.
Yeah.
About the same.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure. I was up rather late watching your... I know you work very well. I've read several of your books and love them and have talked to you before. But I was up late watching the tape series, the booklet of which I have in my hand, Great Courses on Tapes, Biology, and Human Behavior, the Neurological Origins of Individuality, and was up late because the last two tapes are my favorite, and that's part of what I'm going to pull from today.
Well, that's amazing. That makes you one of about three people in America who's actually looked at that. That's great.
Oh, no, that's silly. Come on. They're wonderful, wonderful lecture series, and it's fun to watch you pace back and forth and try to do interesting things with your hands because it's a visual medium and have little pictures. It's actually very... You're a wonderful teacher. I mean, it's not at all surprising that your students are so happy with you. We've developed a newish part of our brain, which I discussed a little bit. I did a solo show last week where I talked about... I took a stab at forgive the analogy, at giving people some advice on how to cope with stress in terms of nutrition and exercise and yada yada. But I discussed the neocortex clumsily. But it occurs to me that it's the part of our brain that enables us to be self-conscious and self-reflective. It's probably the seat of empathy. But this ability to create abstract thought can turn against us as we anticipate events, you know, that we think are going to be like the other ones we've experienced. So you want to...
Absolutely. And in a sense, that's the key to understanding why we all feel horrible since September 11th, on a number of levels, all of which revolve around this neocortex that we humans and primates specialize in. We have a capacity to empathize. We have a capacity to empathize with somebody 3,000 miles away. We have a capacity to have a very refined sense of thinking about the future, and that's a future that seems fairly distressing at this point. All of these are profoundly neocortical features of humans. And you take, oh, I don't know, some farmer who sits and watches the rainy season fail to arrive in his agricultural village in East Africa kind of thing, and even though he is not starving at that moment, his body will be having the same stress response as if he were starving, built around this cognitive neocortical anticipation that bad stuff is coming down the line if it doesn't rain. All of us have been running on neocortical stress for the last 2 weeks now.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how thoughts change the automatic... I'm not getting words good. See what happens when you keep me up late? Autonomic regulation.
Yeah.
I always say, when I say autonomic, I think the way for people to remember that is to think automatic.
Much easier.
Yeah.
And thus, of course, science has never adopted the more easy version. In a sense, what the punchline is there is we turn on the autonomic, the automatic nervous system with thoughts in the exact same way that we turn it on if we were running for our lives. And this is kind of the punchline of understanding stress-related disease. We have this stress response thing we turn in on our bodies. The part that is most famous is we have an adrenaline surge. We secrete this hormone, adrenaline, epinephrine. You know, that's one of a dozen different hormones that we turn on. But we have this whole coordinated stress response. And for 99% of the beasts out there, you turn it on when you are running for your life because somebody's trying to eat you, or you are very intent on eating somebody else, or basically you're just having this sudden massive energy demand in your body. And what you do at those times is very logical. You mobilize energy to your exercising muscle. You increase your heart rate. You increase your blood pressure so you can deliver that energy as fast as possible. You turn off everything that is not essential for surviving the next 30 seconds. You shut down growth and tissue repair and digestion and reproduction and all of that stuff. And that makes perfect sense. And where it doesn't make any sense whatsoever is when we sit and we turn on that exact same stress response, which is what we do thanks to our neocortex, when we think about the ozone layer and people in refugee camps and late Beethoven string quartets, or all of the events of the last 2 weeks, which for most of us, fortunately, have not been as real as running for your life across the savannah. We turn on the exact same thing in those cases, and that's not what our bodies were evolved for.
There's an, you know, it's when you take apart the thing that's wonderful about reading your books, and I thought also watching the videotapes, is that there's such intricacy in the interplay. It's the counterpoint and interplay between all of our functions in terms of messengers and how information is communicated to various parts of the body. So that's hormones and neurotransmitters, which we'll talk about in a bit. But there's one substance called LTP, which helps us to go, oh, this thing happened, and it's, you know, it's an adaptive. It enables us to learn from repetition so that things get less scary. You know,
yep.
You know, I didn't like the elevator the first time I went in it, and then I went back, and it was easier kind of thing. But it's interesting that you mentioned that stress has a rather unpleasant effect on LTP.
And, you know, once you see the nuts and bolts of this, it's something that we all learned somewhere back when, the first time we stressed ourselves by staying up all night doing an all-nighter before an exam the next morning, and what do you know, your brain doesn't function very well at 9 the next morning. I mean, what LTP is, you got neurons, they're the cells in your brain, they talk to each other, they release chemical messengers. And when you learn something, when you suddenly get it, when you get an aha and some fact registers in this amazingly, like, concrete, reductive way, something has just changed in your brain. And what that something is two of those neurons or 2,000 of those neurons are now communicating with each other in a more excitable way, in a potentiated way. That's the jargon in the field. And if it lasts a long time, it's now called LTP, long-term potentiation. And this is basically connections between neurons are more jumpy, they're more excitable. These particular neurons, this is what remembering stuff is. And what has been an amazingly important finding is that a little bit of stress makes LTP work better. And we have a technical term for a little bit of stress, the right amount of stress. We call it stimulation. You know, it's not for nothing. You don't learn very well when you're in a coma. You need a certain level of arousal and vigilance. And short-term, moderate amounts of stress make this LTP business work better. It makes memory work better. But if stress gets too severe and if it goes on for too long, all of the nuts and bolts of the system tells you the same thing. You don't do this LTP stuff very well anymore. Memory doesn't work very well. And people have known this clinically for years. Memory really gets shot, gets distorted in very bad ways with chronic stress.
I first became interested in physiology when I was studying exercise physiology. And it's interesting that all of these different cascades that happen in our body actually are, there's a similar quality to the lessons we learn from them. And one of the things you learn early on is that exercise is a good thing, but that exercise is a form of stress, and that there's good stress and bad stress, that learning things in a happy way is good stress, but it's still stress. And stress requires something that people in our culture seem not to like, which is enough rest so that your body can adapt and learn and grow muscles and do things. And we don't like that. We don't like to stop. So I think that part of what you're saying here is that stress becomes distress when there isn't enough recovery built in. Is that part of what you're saying?
Yep, exactly. If the stressor itself is too big, if the stressor goes on for too long, or, as you say, just as importantly, if the recovery period is not long enough. That's exactly the sort of ways in which one gets into trouble.
So what we're starting to talk about here is how stress causes disease, and it's interesting to note that the diseases that people often think of stress causing are things like cancer. People think that they cause their own cancers, and I'm often, I feel very protective of people who have illnesses which have a je ne sais quoi, which have a quality that we may not have control over. There may be some noceums that we're getting exposed to. So I worry about people thinking, I was angry at my mother for too long, or I was mean to my kids and now I have cancer, like it's some kind of, you know, Old Testament God cancer. And instead, actually, cancer seems to be less, I mean, certainly all disease process is going to be, the body's more cumbersome under stress, so it's not going to behave very well, and it's not going to be able to back things down. But there are other diseases that are very prevalent under stress that are much more prevalent than something like cancer.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought up cancer, because that's one of my official soapboxes to climb up on and yell and holler. Stress has a tremendous impact on disease. Virtually every organ system in the body is adversely affected by stress. I make my living by preaching that, blah, blah. Nonetheless, when you get to the realm of cancer really has nothing to do with stress. There is zero scientific evidence that stress or stress hormones can cause any type of cancer. There is virtually no evidence that stress can make a pre-existing cancer grow faster. And for the little evidence that that is the case, that applies to types of cancers that humans almost never get. It's an area where stress simply doesn't have an impact. And that one you got to emphasize over and over, because as you said, all sorts of surveys. There was a paper, I believe, in Journal of the American Medical Association last year, taking a bunch of women with metastatic breast cancer and saying, well, where do you think this came from? And the most common answer was stress. And there's simply no basis for it. And that's absolutely setting somebody up for being on their deathbed saying, geez, too bad I never learned how to relax. Too bad I never reconciled my relationship with my mother, etc., the versions you brought up. And, you know, bad science, bad medicine, bad ethics.
You're blaming the victim, you know.
Absolutely.
It's one of my soapbox as well. The only time that I can see cancer, which is much more complicated, but I'll take a very fast side trip since I brought it up. The only time I can imagine that cancer might have been increased by stress is that when people push on, stress out or push constantly themselves, and their adrenal cortex is producing a lot of cortisol. The presence of a lot of cortisol, as you talk about endlessly, has an effect on the other hormones in the body, and it has effect on the sex hormones, and it has effect on things like insulin, as I understand it.
Yep.
And insulin is a growth factor. So if you, I would think that just as you say, homeostasis in the presence of stress, you often described as two elephants on a seesaw. It becomes very heavy and very cumbersome and very difficult. In that same way, if there's an imbalance in the hormones because people are hiking themselves up on coffee and sugar and just stressing themselves utterly out and running on adrenaline and causing this high cortisol reaction, there's often a change in the growth factors and the balance of hormones. And I'm sure that can be a contributing, but not by itself, a cause.
Yep, absolutely. And stress certainly gets you into the confounding factors. When people are stressed, many people are more likely to do the sorts of things that set you up for cancer, medicate, smoke, drink to excess, et cetera, et cetera. Likewise, people who, once they have cancer, stress reduction has been associated with a better outcome.
Very much so.
What's that one about? Probably not because of any direct effect of stress on the biology of cancer growth, because again, there's virtually no evidence for that, but stress management helps give you the energy and peace of mind to stick with a really tough, unpleasant medication regimen, to go the extra round of chemo, all those sorts of things that take sort of a heroic focus, and that stress makes a lot harder.
Well, there's some people who don't do heroic measures and do stress reduction things and do quite well. And I think we can't deny that there's some role that the brain has in terms of wanting you to be, if you want to be here.
Sure.
You know, if life is worth living, to put it simply. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with neurobiologist Professor Robert Sapolsky from Stanford, author, as you may have read, I hope if you haven't read it, you will, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, along with a new book about your experiences in Africa with the primates. And I'm very bad. I don't have the name of your new book.
A Primate's Memoir.
That's right. And I've, you know, seen the name, and my brain is so full of information I'm trying to hang on to. So we are doing a show on the biology of stress. The most compelling illness that I think stress does cause, and you talk a lot about, is depression. And not just a blue, not feeling blue. We're talking major symptoms.
Yep. Depression. Absolutely. And this is one that just has to get hammered in over and over. Horrifying disease, horrifyingly common, horrifyingly misinterpreted by people around depressives. Oh, come on, pull yourself together. This is a biochemical disorder. And it's one where you can't begin to understand the biology of depression without seeing the role of stress in it. And very pertinent to the last 2 weeks.
Now, what's interesting about it is that in my reading, when we say biochemical cause, the biochemistry of depression and stress is very different from the simplistic biochemistry that I see being pushed by people who are pushing the use of, for instance, SSRIs. That's very simplistic. I think that that it's much more complex how stress or just not being treated well throughout your life in some way or another, or being raised in a stressful family and then dealing with stress later, is going to have on people, and how that cascade of events and how they, and we're going to get into this, how it changes your hormones, how that can lead to the biochemistry of depression rather than it being just simply, you know, if you need more serotonin. It isn't that simple.
Absolutely. And I think most of the people working in that area, sort of my biochemistry colleagues, essentially what they're doing is coming up with a balance between nobody in their right mind would say, aha, here's the solution, here's what it's all about, but nonetheless, this buys you some therapeutic efficacy to some extent. But absolutely, this is not a single gene disorder where have that mutation and you've got the disease. What the genetics tends to suggest is even with the strongest genetic propensity towards depression, you only have about a 50% chance of getting the disease. And what that translates into is that this is a partially genetic disorder that is overwhelmingly dependent on what kind of environment you wind up in. And stressful ones aren't good.
It might be worth mentioning here that when we're talking about depression, I think one of the major characteristics of depression, and it's interesting because I forget this, especially when I'm depressed, is that it changes your perception of the way things are, that it alters perception, and that one of the ways you can tell when you're in trouble is that you're painting everything one, you know, color, but basically black. Everything is, there's an inconsolability to it. There's a lack of capacity for seeing any other possibility except darkness.
Absolutely. On a first pass, what depression is about is it's a disease of emotion, negative emotion. You feel bad. On a very fundamental level, it's also a disease of abnormal thinking, of cognitive distortion, where all of, you know, forget the glasses being half empty. They're entirely empty in your view. And this could be shown in all sorts of studies. I mean, classic sort of cognitive therapy type studies, you take a depressive or you take a bunch of people, you show them a picture of a bunch of people sitting around a dinner table celebrating something, then a picture of the same bunch of people sitting around a coffin mourning something, flash up both pictures, flash them in rapid sequence back and forth, that sort of thing. Which picture did you see? And your average person, 50-50 chance of which they report, show it to the depressive, they see the coffins, they see the glasses is always half empty. There's this cognitive distortion which most often takes the form of not only perceiving bad things as being as bad as they really are, but seeing that extending into realms where it isn't necessarily bad. The jargon that's used in the field is depressives have a sense of learning to have been helpless.
Yes, exactly.
There's nothing I can do. It's not going to work out.
Yeah, and we know from all the early studies on stress that helplessness is the type of stress which is the hardest on the body.
Yep.
So this is interesting because what we've just said is that thoughts change the autonomic nervous system.
Yep.
It changes the relationship between the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, which is, you know, the part that puts you to sleep and the part that makes you very excited, both good and bad. So it's this interesting sense that depression is a learned disease, and that people who have learned it at an early age are going to be more vulnerable.
And intersecting with the biology, that we have different biological thresholds as to how much of that, this is a bad world out there and there's often nothing you can do about it, how much of that sort of learning do you need to be exposed to hit that threshold of everything's bad and there's nothing I can do about it. Some folks are much more prone towards reaching that state than others for biological reasons, but once again, it's a biology of how you respond to an environment.
Now, the reason I'm going down this path, so that listeners understand where I'm going, is that it is my firm belief always with this show, it is sort of the mission of this show, that if I can teach people a little bit about the science of how their bodies work, they will have an opportunity, as time goes on and they learn these principles, to make some decisions. Not that you can just tighten your tushy and make everything fine. I think you can say that on the air. Because the FCC are not all Jewish people. I think if you we're not saying that if you just tighten your belt loops and suck it in that you'll be fine. What I am saying, though, is that the more, for instance, reading Dr. Sapolsky's book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, the next time you're in a traffic jam and you're getting really out of control with your emotions, there's a part of your brain that can say, oh, no, I know now what I'm doing to my body by doing this. So let's see if I can just cool out a little bit here and get some perspective. That's why I'm doing this. Okay, so the effect of stress on our organs and our glands, we can't go to that next spot without talking about neurotransmitters and hormones. What about the difference between them? That might be a good place to start.
Let's see, hopefully we can do this without 90% of the people immediately turning off the radio.
Glazing over.
Science phobic horror. You know, neurons have to talk to each other in order to communicate. When they release a chemical, when one brain cell releases a chemical that talks to another brain cell, we call it a neurotransmitter. When one cell in your body releases a messenger which instead gets into your bloodstream and goes all over your body and sends messages, we call it a hormone. And that's the basic difference.
Yeah, they communicate slightly differently with the cells. And neurotransmitters are often what people in my audience are probably thinking is things like when people use individual amino acids in a pharmacological way, like taking glutamine for an effect on craving in the brain or something, or for stomach or something like that, or GABA, which has a relaxing effect. These are neurotransmitters.
Yep.
And hormones are actually more complex than just estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, et cetera, et cetera. There are some other hormones that are fascinating. There is a very interesting concept, or not even concept, there's an interesting sort of thing that happens, which is another metaphor for everything in the world, which I always think science gives us, which is the up and down regulation of how the cells adapt to more or less of having enough of either neurotransmitters, which can be like happy chemicals, or hormones, which can also be like happy chemicals. Why more isn't always better?
Very important, subtle point. If somebody always yells at you, you stop listening after a while. In a sense, is a protective compensation. And in much the same way, if you just flood some cell or some tissue or some organ with some chemical messenger, a neurotransmitter or a hormone, if you just pound them over the head over and over again with that chemical messenger, that target cell or tissue is going to start listening less. And on a technical level, what that involves is that target cell has a receptor for that messenger, a estrogen receptor, a serotonin receptor, whatever, and it actually has a whole bunch of them, and it starts making fewer of them. It starts decreasing the number of those receptors and thus decreasing its sensitivity to that messenger. And an awful lot of what's very complicated about trying to do pharmacology in the brain is, okay, you decide the reason for this disease or a psychiatric disorder is there's not enough of messenger X, so here's messenger X in a pill and flood it and send a ton of it into the brain, and it doesn't help. How come? Because you go and discover that the brain, in response to this vastly increased amount of messenger X, has down-regulated, has decreased its levels of messenger X receptor, and the net result is you're not getting any more of a signal through the system.
Yeah, your tissues become desensitized in a simplistic way. It might not be perfectly scientific, but it's like, think eating lots of Reese's peanut butter cups all the time, and your ability to make the sort of happy chemicals that your body gets from the sugar and all of that, your own body just sort of goes, psst, why bother? And it becomes sort of foggy and desensitized. There's one researcher who calls this mitochondria myopathy. You know, that your mitochondria say, I don't need to make any energy from fat. I've got all the sugar. And the same thing with hormones. People who are taking replacement hormones in menopause or andropause, which I don't think you totally agree with, but maybe you do. I don't know. But in any case, you find, I see in my own educational practice that people come to me and they're taking scads and scads of some hormone like estrogen, and they're getting very, very severe low estrogen symptoms, and it's because they've completely overwhelmed their system and the tissue's going, this is you can't even respond anymore. So.
Yep, that is a frequent problem. Or it's a disease state that hits an amazing number of Americans, which is adult onset diabetes.
Yes.
The other name for that being insulin resistant diabetes.
Yes.
Normally what you do is you got insulin in your bloodstream as a signal, you just had a big meal, and here's a signal to your fat cells to take up some fat and store it away. And if, because you don't exercise anymore and you've put on weight and you're sedentary and all of that, and your fat cells are stuffed full, they stop listening to the insulin. And mechanistically, what the, quote, insulin resistance is about is those cells with their insulin receptors, they disconnect the insulin receptors.
That's
they pull the plugs on them. And that creates a lot of pathology.
Yeah, it's sort of like, if you're not listening, listen to this. We're going to have to take a brief musical break. And when you come back, we're going to return with our interview with Stanford.
What to think? Well, I got some consolation. I'll give it to you if I might. You know, I don't worry about a thing, cause I know nothing's going to be all right. You know, this world is just a one big trouble spot, cause some have plenty and some have not. You know, I used to be troubled, but I finally saw the light. Now I don't worry about a thing, cause I know nothing's going to be alright.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. on the phone with Stanford professor and neuroscientist Dr. Robert Sapolsky, and we are talking about the biology of stress, something which everybody's studying internally right now. If you miss parts of today's show and want to get a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can always dial my information number at 707-874-2772. So we're talking about how stress affects the levels and activities of hormones. Well, actually, we're working on that. We're talking about up and down regulation. Now we're going to talk about how stress affects the levels and activities of hormones.
In very complicated ways, as it turns out. You know, the most basic piece that everybody knows is your adrenaline surge, which is really the first wave of the stress response. Adrenaline, epinephrine from your sympathetic nervous system, that's the hormone that has sort of the first task of mobilizing energy, increasing your heart rate, all that sort of stuff. A latter wave of hormones released, as you mentioned before, are these adrenal steroid hormones, like hydrocortisone, the other name for it, cortisol. And in a very crude sort of way, you can think of that as kind of the system that backs up adrenaline's actions. But there's scads of other hormones that get activated during stress. You secrete beta endorphin, and that's got something to do with why certain types of stress, you tend to blunt your pain perception. In the meantime, you're decreasing the secretion of certain hormones. You secrete less growth hormone. You secrete less estrogen, testosterone, all as part of this business of, you know, grow your long bones tomorrow, ovulate some other day. Don't do it right now while you're running for your life. This whole business of triaging, turning off all the unessentials.
So the endocrine system and our sex hormones are affected by stress, but it can also determine how we handle stress. How healthy our endocrine system is. So
sure.
It's this chicken and egg, and that's neuroendocrinology.
Which is this horrible business where you just get a whole bunch of different organs and glands and hormones, and you put them on a big chart, and you draw an arrow from every single one of them to every single other one of them, and then you let the whole system run, and because everything regulates each other in exactly that sort of way.
But, you know, what's interesting is that they don't do things completely intuitive. For people, for most people, it's not intuitive. It's intuitive to say, let's not reproduce today. It's not a good day to do that. I'm not in a good mood, and life is caca. So let's not do that today, and so your sex hormones are down. But there are other things that happen endocrinologically. I'm glad I was able to say that word. That are surprising. Not all of this has to do with stress, but there are things like I suddenly can't pronounce this word, and I know it. The part of the brain that's affected by testosterone and its effect on aggression. The
amygdala. Yes, amygdala.
Amygdala. It sounds Indian, doesn't it? Sounds like something you should pray to. We're very happy because we sit in meditation in front of the amygdala. Oh, I'm going to get in trouble. Okay, stop that. Nope. Okay, the amygdala and testosterone.
Latin name, I believe it actually means walnut or almond or something in Latin, which if you're a neuroanatomist and you're really, like, deprived of normal sensory stimulation, after a while an amygdala actually does begin to look like that.
Okay, so what about how it and testosterone has an effect on aggression? Because right now, you know, as you've often said, there, more guys seem to be getting behind the war machine than women, although it's really hard for me to tell that for sure. But you always talk about, you know, gee, maybe testosterone does have some effect on aggression because it looks like men. I think we're catching up, though. I think women are catching up. But anyway, so what is it? Is it true? Is it testosterone poisoning?
No.
That's what I thought.
It's a huge piece of unlearning that lots of people have to come across. Males in species after species are, on the average, more aggressive than females. Amongst males, on the average, at the time of life when testosterone levels are higher, aggression tends to be higher. In species where males have seasonal mating and testosterone boosts up only at certain times of year, that's when aggression tends to get higher. So on a first pass, testosterone seems to keep showing up on the scene as sort of a suspect when there's more aggression around. you then prove that testosterone really does have something to do with it by doing the classic kind of experiment in endocrinology, which is you take away the testosterone and does the aggression go away at that point? And you do that experiment in all sorts of different species, including humans, and on the average, aggression levels go down. And at that point, you finish that classic experiment, you replace the testosterone, and on the average, aggression comes back. Okay, so testosterone's got something to do with it. Question then being, what does testosterone have to do with aggression? And there's this part of the brain, the amygdala, that's involved in aggression. And not surprisingly, the amygdala has more receptors for testosterone than any other part of the brain. So there's immediately this image of, oh, what testosterone does is get into the brains of all of these males and just sort of marinates the amygdala in this testosterone and causes these neurons to just start firing all over the place. And that's not what it does. And the metaphor that I always use for that is this notion that what testosterone does is go in and turn on this radio that's now playing sort of martial military music. That's not what testosterone does. What testosterone does instead is goes into the amygdala and interacts with those testosterone receptors. And what it does is if and only if those neurons are already electrically excited, testosterone makes them more excited. In other words, it's not turning on the radio, but if the radio is already turned on, it increases the volume. It lowers the threshold for excitability. And translated into sort of the behavioral level, it means that minor irritants or provocations that wouldn't push some organism to the point of aggression are more likely to do so when you're aggressive, when you have lots of testosterone around, rather.
Yeah, but it's also interesting to note that when you did studies with primates, that only the, as you said, this is just repeating what you said, that only the aggressive primates became aggressive. The one, no matter how much you once said, if you give one of these characters a non-physiologic dose enough to grow, what was it, to grow hair on his what?
Oh, that, like every neuron in the amygdala is like growing antlers. And
growing antlers and everything. Everything's growing hair. They don't necessarily get more aggressive. It isn't always the case.
Well, they don't. Here's like the perfect study that demonstrates this. This is this classic study. Take yourself five male rhesus monkeys and let them live together, and they work out a dominance hierarchy, and there's numbers 1 through 5, and 1 makes life miserable for 2 through 5, and 2 for 3 through 5, and that sort of thing. Now take number 3 and give him boatloads of testosterone. And on the average, yes, indeed, he's going to get into more aggressive interactions than he did before. Does that mean number 3 is suddenly going to be challenging number 2? Not at all. What you wind up seeing is number 3 has become a total pain in the ass to numbers 4 and 5. You're not changing the social structure of aggression. You're exaggerating what's already there. You're exaggerating what has been socially learned. And testosterone is very, very rarely the cause of a behavior. What it does is just lower the threshold for the environmental triggers. It just ups the volume.
My own observation also is that, and I'm going cautiously here because I don't know what your opinion is on this, but you talk a bit on your videotape series, which is called Biology and Human Behavior, The Neurological Origins of Individuality, which comes from The Teaching Company, which is on the web at www.teachco.com, www.teachco.com, if you want to get a copy of this 8-lecture series on biology and human behavior, the neurological origins of individuality, that you found the early research on grinding up testes from various sources and injecting them into men as being a placebo effect. But I think there is evidence that as men, as women also, men and women age, there is some change in the amount of hormones and that the hormones have some effect. We've already said if you give too much, it has no effect or a bad effect. If you give the right amount, maybe. In any case, my own observation is that men who are low, who test low in testosterone, in my experience, tend to be grouchier.
Well, I actually...
They usually feel better, and they also often feel more access to their emotional life when they have a comfortable amount of testosterone on board.
Well, that's interesting. I actually don't know a whole lot of guys where I happen to know their testosterone levels.
Yeah. But, well, we can talk at some other time about that.
we should all come with our ingredients label.
Yeah, that's it. I think so. I think men should have an ingredients label and an instruction booklet. The stomach hormone CCK, which signals satiety. Here's something that is affected by stress.
True. And it taps into one of the great puzzles of stress, which is you get a whole audience full of people, and you're telling them about the effects of stress on the body, and chronic stress, and psychological stress, and social stress, and how bad it is for you, and what it does to this, that, and the other in your body. And then you say, okay, how many of you, when you're stressed, lose your appetite, and half the hands go up, and how many of you, when you're stressed, go through boxes of Oreos, mm-hmm. and the other half of the hands go up? Oh, stress does something to appetite. This really doesn't tell us a whole lot. It turns out that there's actually a very logical structure to what stress does to appetite, satiety, things of that sort. The hormones you secrete very early on in the stress response, such as epinephrine, adrenaline, the very first wave of the stress response, what those hormones tend to do is shut down appetite. And framed again in the context of how normal beasts on this planet get stressed, that makes perfect sense. You're running for your life. Don't think about lunch at this point. You know, shut down that whole system. Concentrate on saving yourself. The very early phase thus shuts down appetite. What you're also doing at that stage is mobilizing energy from every storage site in your body to hand to those thigh muscles that are saving your life. Okay, it turns out the later phase of hormones that you secrete during stress, what they tend to do is help you with the recovery process. And when the stressor is over with, what do you need to do then? You need to get energy to store back into all those storage sites because you emptied out the bank account during that sprint. And the characteristic of the late phase, the recovery phase from the stress, is you increase your appetite and you increase energy storage. So suddenly you say, okay, what does stress do to appetite? And it winds up basically being built around, well, how much of your time are you being stressed and how much of your time are you recovering from stress? And if you get stressed for 5 continuous nonstop hours in a day, that's going to be a very different biology than if 5 total hours of stress are broken into 30 different episodes during the day, because in the first case you have one recovery period, and in the second case you've got 30. How much of your time are you in the let's get hungry and store away some fat and sugar here at this point because we just had a major stressor and had to run for our life even though we haven't seen the latest saber-toothed tiger today? That's why it's being critical. What's the patterning of stress you have during the day?
What we're sort of moving into is we've been talking about the importance of the receptors and how they function in determining, to some extent, the receptors and how the neurotransmitters and the hormonal balance and how the whether or not the receptors are working well or oddly, and that determines to some extent individual behavior of individuals. What I'm trying to do is move in the direction of thoughts and adaptations and lifestyle changes that might be protective for us. But I think before we go there, it's good to note that things that are usually considered pathological are things that come up in people who are not clinically pathological under stress, like repetition compulsion. Right?
Yep.
So that's pretty common. You mentioned that people shouldn't get scared for themselves if they start acting like they might be a little obsessive compulsive. People joke about it, but in fact, we do get that way when we're frightened.
We try to invent structure when the world seems like it's made of quicksand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it also, before I move on to the healing part, I also want to say something about the fact that in my own experience talking to people, it strikes me that when people have bodies that have been responding to trauma and stress since childhood, since very early childhood, and gosh, some research shows that maybe we're responding to it even before birth, that there's a question of how much healing can occur in damaged, I'm going to say tissue, for lack of a better word. We're really talking about glands and all kinds of other things, too. But for instance, an example is if you are exercising, which is good for you, and you make a mistake and you injure a muscle, it is the case that if you care for it well and you keep it strong by not completely stopping all exercise, when you, you know, this thing that people do, I'm injured, I have to now go lay down forever. You want to keep moving because an injured muscle becomes weaker faster than any other muscle. You don't want to hurt it more, but you care for the muscle and you try to re-strengthen it and stuff. People who have been badly injured know that you never completely go back to the way it was before it was injured, and that you have to, in some way, develop some compassion, and you have to adapt to the ways in which you might not have the same strength in that area. You might learn to use your body in a different way. But what I'm saying here is that when people have been wounded from early childhood and their adaptations that occur, there's healing that can take place. But it may be worthwhile, I think, for people to make some adaptation around how much they expect of themselves. Not that you expect less of yourself as a human being, but that you give yourself, you cut yourself some slack.
No, that's a very good point. And it absolutely taps into the subject of stress management. I mean, a huge chunk of that immediately brings to mind the Serenity Prayer, which is when you look at the building blocks of psychological stress, and that's back to neocortex, and that's back to our human ability to be stupendously stressed about events 3,000 miles away. When you look at that, a large element of that is built around feeling out of control. And one of the worst ways in which we ask too much of ourselves psychologically is when, in a sense, we feel responsible for trying to control the uncontrollable. I mean, we talked about one specific version of that earlier, this absolutely just pernicious sense of cancer as a stress-related disorder, and thus you should be able to control it if only you could sign up for the right brand of stress management, checks accepted. And that generalizes all across the board. It is extremely destructive when people try to control what has already occurred, try to control the inevitable, and that's one way in which people certainly often ask too much of themselves, and that's extremely stressful.
There's something else that comes up, which is something that I wonder about. Well, wait a minute. I'm getting off my topic here. We were going to talk about adaptations and lifestyle changes that are protective. So let's do that. Let me hear from you, because I did a whole show on it last week. Some of the things that you recommend to people for handling stress so that it doesn't become corrosive.
Well, let's see. This is going to be fairly abstract. Parentheses, useless advice, because I'm much, much more expert at knowing how to generate stress than how to get rid of it. But nonetheless, I mean, what a lot of studies show is for the same external stressor, for the same external reality, for the same external kick in the rear, you are much more likely to get a stress-related disease if you feel like you have no control. If you feel like there's no predictability about the stressor, you don't know when it's coming, how bad it's going to be, how long it's going to last. If you feel like you have no outlets in response to the stressor, if none of your coping mechanisms are available to you, if you feel like you don't have social support, and these initially seem like fairly fuzzy concepts, this is actually very, very hard science. You take, you know, a bunch of volunteers, and you sit each one of them in a room, and each one, every now and then, you blast some 1 second really loud, irritating siren in there at 120 decibels, and that's really quite distressing, and it occurs unpredictably, and half the people sit there, that's simply being done to them, and half the people sit there being exposed to the exact same pattern of stressors as the people in the first group. But the difference here is you put a little button in there and say, you know, by pressing that, you decrease the likelihood of these alarms going off. And in fact, the button does nothing. It's a complete placebo. And those people don't have as much of a stress response. Totally independent of the fact that they don't actually have any control over this, that sense of control there minimizes the stress response. These are extremely real variables.
Okay. So are we marketing these? Are you making these available to people?
The placebo button? Yes, and little levers.
Well, but we have little levers and placebo buttons. There are things like, reminding yourself how you got where you are and what decisions you made to get there. I know that sounds silly, but sometimes when you get into a bad job that you don't like or something, it's worthwhile to remember why you took the job. You're like, oh, yeah, that's right. I was really under pressure to make some money now, and the reason I want that is because I have this relationship and children or something, and I have to, you know, so there's a reason why I'm here,
yep,
you know, putting up with it. So that's one way. The other way is, gosh, getting a little exercise.
Yep.
You know.
Or, you know, let me really tread on some thin ice here and probably get you all sorts of irate phone calls afterward. But, you know, in the aftermath of September 11th, what the huge psychological literature on stress management shows you is that even hitting levers that are placebos and giving you a sense of control and predictability decreases the stress response, blah, blah. One of the ways that pressing of placebo buttons have been all over the place since September 11th is the way in which all of this disaster and the rationalizations for it and the rationalizations for our responses have been framed in the context of there is a God and this God has some opinion about what went on and this God is voting for one of the sides and what happens next. For mine, obviously, sitting there on an extreme stance, that's a very logical placebo button that people are hitting to decrease the stressfulness of this time.
Well, it's everybody, you know, as somebody once said, whatever blows your dress up. So, you know, if it works, do it. I think for some of us, exercise is probably good. I mean, I'm not saying that believing that there is a larger thing. Anyway, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to let you do that one. You know, where I go, though, is that I look at things like from your book, how male primates, these baboons who have a hierarchical society, how some of the males don't buy into the hierarchy. They
yeah.
just decide to drop out, and they hang out with the girls, and they don't fight, you know, and they get more sex, and they do less stress response. They just decide not to. So here's a situation where there's a pretty compelling reason for them to believe that they're in a position where they don't have a choice. And they do have a choice.
Yeah. Many of our roles are assigned to us, and they need not, we don't necessarily have to follow them. And it's amazing to see even non-human primates occasionally do that. That's been this very exciting sort of revolution in primatology, the discovery that the world of primates and primate competition and leaving as many copies of your genes as possible does not come down to something as simplistic as what female primates are about is having babies and being a competent mother, and what male primates is about is being aggressive and defeating other males for sexual access to females. That's not our primate roots in the slightest, because that's not what any primate is about, as it turns out.
So they, what, are doing poetry? What is it?
The jargon in the field is alternative strategies, and
uh-huh.
in some ways the most interesting one is the one you just brought
yeah.
up, which is, you know, you look at a subset of males, even in primate species that are characterized by males being big, aggressive individuals where there's very little paternal behavior on the part of males, baboons, for example, rhesus monkeys, etc. And what you wind up seeing there is a subset of these guys don't do the male-male aggression, and these guys don't do the competition for female access by defeating other males, and what they do is this incredibly radical, obscure notion of they form friendships with females. And that's actually a term that's used in the field, friendships, special relationships, and they're nice guys. And they get groomed more often, and they live longer, and they don't get injuries. And what some of my work has shown is they've got better cholesterol levels and less stress hormones and all of that. Okay, at this point, if you're a certain cynical type of guy out there, you're sitting there saying, oh, great, you know, you get in touch with your feminine side if you're a male baboon, and you get more lice picked off of you, and this sounds like some sort of baboon chick flick or something after a while. What's the most amazing thing is you do the hard-nosed, bottom-line business that Darwinian biologists care about. You look at numbers of copies of genes being passed on, and these guys out-reproduce
mm-hmm.
the guys doing the Arnold Schwarzenegger scene.
Mm-hmm.
And by the rules of evolution, this is a winning strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a case where it's turning out nice guys are most definitely not finishing last.
Are there primates that fight to death like we do?
Yeah, but
oh,
not
that's
very
too bad.
Often.
Not so often, huh?
Not as often.
It's not like Planet of the Apes, then.
no, but Certainly, there's lots of these individuals I've observed over the years that if they could master the technology of Uzis, mm-hmm. they would sure use them.
Mm-hmm. So maybe Planet of the Apes isn't so far.
Yeah, very little in the world of real animal behavior resembles Disney, as it turns out. Lots of unpalatables, but lots of unpalatables that don't necessarily translate into that something inevitable about behavior, including us.
So you didn't find anything in the film that you found sort of amusing and real?
Oh, I actually haven't gotten around to see it yet.
Oh my God, how could you not?
Well, I guess I'm just still so attached to my images of Charlton Heston in a loincloth from when I was a kid.
But he's in this movie.
He is?
Yes.
Oh my.
I'm not going to ruin the surprise for you. He's in the movie, and he's in a role that's going to, it turns the whole thing around. It's going to be very funny.
Oh.
Yep, see, now you have to go see it.
I need to go right now.
And I have to find, you have to email me and tell me what you thought.
Okay.
There's also a very cute little, precoital scene in it. There's a very funny little, you know, seduction scene in it that I think you'll appreciate. Last thing I wanted to ask you about is aging in the brain. One of the things that you've written about is that as people get older, it isn't just that they think that only the good music was from when they were kids, that, you know, the Beatles or the, you know, whatever, that it's more than that, that there's a solidifying effect, that people comfort themselves or whatever, but that there's something actually going on neurobiologically in the brain that causes us to get more fixed.
Which
I think is a bad idea. So.
Yes, I agree. For the most part, this was this very depressing study that I did a few years ago, which I wound up publishing in The New Yorker, which is not one of your major scientific outlets, but it was doing, I won't go into the details, but it was canvassing a whole bunch of sources throughout the country looking at issues of what ages are people most open to cultural novelty. At what ages do people form their music tastes? At what ages are people more or less likely to try a new type of food? For that one, I was canvassing 50 different sushi restaurants in the Midwest. What age is somebody most likely to do something as adventurous as getting, you know, a tongue stud? Things of that sort. And it turned out that, you know, by the time you're 35 or so, 95% chance that if you haven't tried any of those things, new music, new food, etc., you're never going to. This window of openness to novelty really slams shut surprisingly early. And a lot of what I did in that piece was then look at, what is this about? Is this due to your brain atrophying? Zero evidence for that. We don't have sushi novelty centers in our brain, and they're not known to undergo any sort of stagnation around age 30 or so. Is this due to peer identification? Is this due to all sorts of psychological phenomena? Turns out there's this whole interesting literature out there built around showing very eminent people get less open to novelty as they get older. And what's that about? It's because if you're eminent, all that novelty is about is you and your buddies are going to get knocked out of the textbooks. And there's this very conservative thing that happens with eminence. What was the most amazing thing in that study to me was, you look at a rat and look at what ages in its life it's willing to try a new food, and it's the exact same curve as for humans. Very conservative about novelty during childhood. Adolescence to young adulthood, there's this craving for novelty, and then on the average, the window closes. So whatever's going on there, this is a very, very biologically rooted phenomenon in lots of species. And as you said, something that's not such a great thing.
So we really have to fight back to avoid becoming cement, basically.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, because we're running out of time.
Yes, definitely in that case.
Well, I hope that you will continue to do the wonderful work that you do, which I think really helps people, and I hope that you're continuing to be supported emotionally by the work you do and your family and everything that you do.
Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah. So keep me apprised of, especially.